Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about a sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, they host different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Oteil Burbridge, Trouble No More, former members of The Band, Milk Carton Kids, Nikki Glaspie, Bill Frisell, Sean Colvin, and many more. This June, join the Fab Four, Joan Osborne, John Sebastian, Marshall Crenshaw, and a great group of faculty for the debut of Magical Mystery Camp. This all-inclusive, once-in-a-lifetime music vacation experience in the heart of the Catskills will be packed with nightly performances, workshops, speakers, song circles, open mics, and a lot more. If you're a performing musician at any level, bring your instrument. If you're a music lover, bring your good spirit. It's an amazing experience for individuals, friends, and couples alike. Registration is open, spots are filling up, so check it out soon. And scholarships are available. Check out magicalmysterycamp.com/helpingfriendly to learn more.
Osiris. What's up? This is Ryan Stasek from Humphreys McGee. This podcast is part of the Osiris podcast family. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts, connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and of course, lots of music. Osiris works in partnership with Relics Magazine. Osiris.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no. My daddy thinks I'm fine. Just try to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go.
Hey everybody, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 147. This is RJ. I'm here with Matt.
Hey, man.
Hi, Matt.
How's it going?
I'm great. Jonathan cannot be with us today, and Brad, do you know where Brad is?
He is, well, Brad's funded by the government, so he's shut down right now. He's not allowed to work.
That's good. So Brad will be back once we build the wall. So you hear a couple other people in the background. We have a fun episode. It's a little bit different, but we think it's going to be fun and an important sort of discussion to have. We've heard a lot from Trey recently about his experience with addiction and recovery, particularly in the SiriusXM Ask Trey features. He got really open about that, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But of course, this issue of recovery and addiction and all that goes beyond Trey and touches a ton of people in our community. And our two guests today have direct experience with this. So we're going to talk to them about their fish journeys and their personal journeys and also just about the fish community and where we are as a community with all these things and what we can do to kind of help each other out. So, and then we'll play some fish music. So Mike Ferguson is our first guest, who's I think has been, you've been on a Quick Hit before, right, Mike?
I have, yeah. I was on for the LA shows this summer.
Yeah, so welcome back and thanks for doing that. How you doing?
Happy. Happy to be here. Happy cool. to be here. Really, really glad to be talking about this. And, you know, after a hot New Year's Eve, that's this seems like a good time to do a podcast anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And our other guest is Jason, who we've been talking to about this topic for a while now. Jason, you reached out, I think, over the summer, and now it's finally have a chance to talk. So thanks for joining.
Yeah, I finally beat you into a state of submission.
No, the timing is good. And it's like I said, it's an important topic. And I do think just before we get into it, I think we should just thank the people at SiriusXM for doing the Ask Trey stuff, because that's been really amazing. We've heard so much, so many nuggets and so much depth about Trey and his life and music and all that. You know, you guys, I'm sure, have listened to all those.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess before we get into it, Matt, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the Phish world. There's Mexico's coming up in what, a month?
Actually 46 days from today that, when we're recording this.
Nice.
Not that you're counting.
No, I only know because my wife like shouted it. She must've seen it on Facebook in the Phish Chicks or something like that. And she shouted it from the other room earlier. She's like 46 days till we're in Mexico. So we're getting ready for that. I'm dieting and doing lots of crunches, getting bathing suit ready. The only time for Phish that you have to like get yourself physically fit, in order to be presentable for at a Phish show.
That's fair. And we have Ghosts of the Forest coming to DC, and they're doing, going through the Northeast. Are they coming near you guys at all, Jason or Mike, or no?
No, not me. No.
Yeah.
No.
Not coming.
They're out here. I have tickets.
Oh, you do have tickets. Awesome. Is that LA?
Yeah, they're playing in LA.
Nice.
That'll be great. That's April-ish. So we got some stuff coming up, and then hopefully summer tour. The one other thing I want to mention is the Amy's Farm video that was released on Phish.net, I guess 2 days ago. That was pretty cool. Did you guys get a chance to check that out?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah, I watched a good chunk of it last night. It's really, really amazing. There was a little bit of video that floated around from that before, but nothing like this. That's like cut together from different angles. And the guy had apparently, you know, great access, like gets right up next to Fishman occasionally. And it's just so cool to see, you know, the scene and what it looked like at that point. And, you know, the state of the band at that point. They look like kids, but they're also like so professional by that point.
It's pretty amazing.
It's like it feels like that's when the polish started to go on, like in a good way. Like they stopped being as messy. I don't know. It's wild to watch, because I think about like, okay, I was 9 when that was shot, so I don't like my Phish memory does not go back that far. So yeah. It was really interesting to see like, oh, this is where the superheroes that I saw for the first time in 98 came from.
Yeah. And I think, and I had the same experience. I love going back and seeing, you know, stuff from that era when I couldn't conceivably have been seeing Phish shows. I can give myself a full pass on that for not having been there. But I think RJ, you probably noticed the same thing that I was actually kind of shocked by last night when I put it on, what happens at the very, very beginning of the show, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I don't remember that from the tapes. Like, obviously, I had these tapes, but Fishman talking about the 2020 vision or something.
Yeah.
Vision 2020.
Yeah.
It's just, he was up there talking about state and local government and issues and advocacy and, you know, exactly the same thing he's doing now, however many decades later.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one thing I noticed, too, was that nobody had cell phones and everybody was paying attention or chatting or talking. It's like nobody was tweeting anything. It was just that was something I picked up quickly. It's like, yeah, it's totally different.
Significantly less vaping, too.
Yes. Less vaping and way more people with very short shorts on. It looked like there's a lot of photos on the Phish.net post, which are cool. And the one thing that was cool, this guy Matt, who released this video, he released it and encouraged people to donate to the Mockingbird, which is obviously the organization behind Phish.net. So that was cool and always good to raise awareness of what Mockingbird does and the great stuff they're up to. Matt, did you have these tapes or CDs? I mean, was Amy's Farm like something that you had early on in your fandom? Because in the tape trading days, it was just like, it was one of the first things that you got automatically.
Yeah, I don't know that I, if I had it like on CD back when I was, first started and was collecting tapes or CDs or anything like that, but I've heard it a lot over the years. I don't always go back to the, like the pre-93-ish days that often. It's great stuff, but I usually go for the years when they started to jam a little bit more.
Yeah.
But of the early stuff, that's definitely one show that I've heard, over and over again. That and Arrowhead Ranch from the same summer.
Right. Yeah. Which is so widely circulated. So we'll post a link to that in case anyone hasn't seen it, but that was a pretty cool thing to come up this week. Is there anything else going on in the Phish world that we should talk about, Matt, from your perspective?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we're sort of entering the quiet time of the year. So, it's good for us to be able to take a step back from the ongoing, current tour and music and everything like that, and take a broader look at the community as we're going to today.
Yeah, and I just want to say, everyone knows that we're part of the Osiris Network, and one of our podcasts, which is called Dark Blue, touches on a lot of the topics that we're going to touch on today. This guy, Jeff Rickley, who's the singer-songwriter for a band called Thursday, he started this podcast, Dark Blue, earlier this year, and he talks to a bunch of artists and people in the arts outside of sort of the jam band genre, but talks about recovery and addiction and all kinds of mental health issues. And so if you really like what you hear here, you might want to check out that podcast. So let's dive in, Matt. Shall we?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, as RJ mentioned, Jason and Mike, who have been open about their road to recovery from substance abuse, and wanted to talk about, how they see the experience for themselves and for others, and especially in light of the fact that Trey has been very open about his own experience over the past 12 years or so, and including in the recent Ask Trey interview on Sirius. So let's start out by just kind of setting the stage. Maybe you guys can tell us a little bit about your own history with Phish, and maybe how your recovery kind of intertwines with that. So Jason, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So my experience with Phish is a backwards kind of introduction. Like, I saw the last Dead show. I saw the Dead before I heard Phish. I heard Phish before I saw the Dead, and then I ended up somehow getting to see the last Dead show, and it was good, and it was okay. But that same fall, 95, is when I saw my first show, 10/21/95, Lincoln, Nebraska. We got there early, ended up getting, I think Pershing Auditorium held like 6,100 people, and we were right up front, like just walked right into general admission and GA, and walked like two people deep from the front, maybe four or five, but we were right there. And I knew maybe probably 50% of the songs, but I knew Tweezer Reprise, and they opened up with that. And it was game on. I mean, literally, just all about it from that moment on. Just fell in love with Phish, fell in love with Trey, everybody. The whole thing was just kind of, at that time, was just, you could feel, it felt like a happening, right? Like something was changing. Like, I mean, Jerry had died, and like whatever happened there, something shifted maybe a little bit. But I caught it right at that time where they were just kind of getting into their, that peak. You guys had done the cast about that 95 and that December, but I just caught it at that time, and I think it hooked me, and I ended up being able to had a family member, actually my sister-in-law, one of her good friends was their caterer, and I didn't know it until the Fox shows that fall, and ended up got invited down to Atlanta and got to go backstage and hang out and sit in the dressing room and watch Mike Gordon talk to young ladies, and while we're cleaning up their silverware, literally, he's like, hey, can you give us a hand, we're trying to get out of here. And like this guy Johnny was his name, and I'm like washing, like in the back of the Fox Theater, washing silverware at a Phish show. And so I was able to, without getting into any detail and all about that, was able to be backstage at quite a few shows between like 95 and Big Cypress, and was at a lot of really good shows. At fall 96 tour, was at Halloween, was at the Nutter Center show, just a lot of good shows and a lot of good times. And And that's where it started. And then once Fish went on their first, we were at Big Cypress. And then once Fish went on that first hiatus, that was it for me until 2015. Didn't go back to see him when they came back. And because I remember going to see him. No, I did. I went to the summer of 2000 in Nashville was when I noticed that something. We were hanging out and we were backstage and in the lot, and something had shifted, you know, as far as what was going on outside and then what was going on, you know, back behind the scenes too. It's just it was getting weird and getting weird fast. So
yeah.
You know, and I was starting to head down that, you know, believe me, I was happy it was going bad because I was one of the ones that was, you know, partaking of the stuff that, you know, that just is not conducive to being functional. And so after that, I didn't see Fish again until 2015 at Alpine. So I had a 15-year hiatus of my own. But so, yeah, over, I think, like 98 shows in 1.0 and then probably a handful in 3.0. But, you know, we could talk forever about that. But, you know, it's just blessed to have been a part of that 95 to 2000 when it was just a really special time. So,
yeah.
Jason, what was it that got you to go back in 2015?
Sobriety. You know, it really was. It was like I felt comfortable enough and things had settled down. Went with a group of people who were sober. And I'm still this way to the day. I can't do the, I don't think I can't. I don't like being on the lawn. I don't like being in the back. I like being close. I was able to be really close and just part of, you know, what it is, what it feels like to be, you know, in that first few rows. And so made it up front at Alpine, and it was so cool. And to know that the person that you admire, not admire, but the person you really, you know, pay a lot of respect to as a musician is up there doing his thing, night in and night out sober. And it was, and that's what brought me back. I really do believe that. So
that's cool. And you got a live Fish release of your first show, which is cool.
Yeah, it was a hot show. I'm sure everybody thinks their first show is their best show, or you should, but listening back to it. Yeah, and it's funny. You can get on the live Fish video and see my goofy head with a baseball hat bouncing around up front. Yeah. Like, that's me. That's me.
Nice.
So, yeah, so that's about it. Yeah.
Excellent. Mike, how about you? Where did things start with for you with Fish?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a house that was pretty musical, and my dad was super into like prog rock. So we had there was like a lot of Yes played in my house growing up. So Fish was really natural when I walked into it. And, you know, it was the older brother of a friend of mine put on, I think it was either a live one or a tape from 93 or something along those lines, and hearing Harry Hood and being like, oh, I got it. Got it. Like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do now. And, and my first show was 98 at UIC. So, my first show, I got a Bag Ghost Rebuff second set with a Farmhouse as a capper. So it wasn't bad. And an acoustic driver that Trey played, and he played something else acoustic too. And I can't remember it right now, but, was it Brian? It might've been Brian and Robert. But yeah, it was, I mean, that the energy at those shows. And I think for me, similar to when we get into talking about addiction, I was always looking for community, and with Fish, it was there and it was everywhere. And if you wanted to go on tour, you could go on tour and be with these people for as long as you want. So I got to a good amount of shows in, you know, 98, 99, 2000. And then, I got sidetracked a little bit, which we'll get into, during the 2003, 2004. So, my Fish hiatus started it after the Deer Creek shows in 03. And then, I came back, for Hampton and when they came back from hiatus. So, and I've seen a bunch of shows in 3.0, and all my 3.0 shows have been sober. So it's interesting to think about, like, coming back to Fish with a different mindset and hearing what came of the band when Trey came back as somebody who was sober. Just it's been interesting. So I've gone to way more shows sober than I have using, and the sober shows, it kind of feels like going to church, but in the good way, like how I assume church used to feel like 50 years ago. And like we're all here for the same purpose, and everybody's there to have a good time, and we're all here to connect with each other and connect with the music. And you can be whoever you are that night and be present. And you know, you can stand next to, or at least for me, I can stand next to somebody on a 10 strip and we can both hear the same notes and just be like, yeah, we're here. We're in this. And that's an amazing thing. I don't think there are many places on earth where we get that.
Nope.
Yeah. And just so on that point, Mike, one of the things that came up in the Ask Trey segment, one of the questions was about how Trey's spiritual life and fish interact. And the answer was, there's a lot packed in that like 3 or 4 minutes. But one of the things that he says at the end is that when he goes out there, he looks out into the crowd and tries to imagine or think about someone in the crowd who might be trying to get sober or who's seeing a show sober. And I think the four of us probably understand that fish and sobriety can go well together. But I think that from the mainstream perspective on fish or the Grateful Dead or anything, it's like the whole point, right, is to go and get fucked up and do drugs. And I'm sure that's not how a lot of fish fans see it, but that's sort of one of the stereotypes. Is that, what is it like? Is you just described it in a way that seems like it's not even really that big of a deal. But I think for a lot of people who are maybe getting sober or thinking about going back to fish after getting sober might be a little worried about it.
Yeah, I mean, similar to, I think about, like, I skipped the O4 shows even though I was sober. Like, I could have gone to Coventry, I could have done Alpine, was close to where I was, and I thought about it, and I just thought I didn't necessarily want to put myself in that environment, but it was my call. It wasn't necessarily the call. I talked to my support group around me and said, you know, this is a band that I love that's really important to me, but I'm worried about being on the scene. And I think what has really resonated for me through the years of now going to, what, like 95 fish shows sober, I think, at this point, is like, as long as I have community, I'm good. And I know where my community is and I stick mm-hmm. with my tribe, I'm pretty good. And as, you know, the longer I've been sober or the longer I've been going to shows, and then you build a little community. And, you know, I was talking to Jason offline the other day just about going to Alpine for the first time in, what was it, 2012, I think they were back there. And that was like my home show. That's where I got into a bunch of trouble the last time I was there, and getting back and going to see it with new eyes and like get in the pit and really just get that humid Midwest sweat of dancing to a ripping jam at fish. Yeah. It's just like, it was awesome. And it kind of gave me a new experience for Alpine, because my last show at Alpine was super dark. And that was like, okay, I can do this a little bit differently and I can be with all of these people. And I think that the promise of fish to me is that you're a person among people when you're there, and that's it. And nobody cares and nobody judges, and you go. And I think that's what the Grateful Dead was like too, from what I've been, you know, from the stories I've heard and what I've been told, is like, that's the entire idea. So there's room for us to be sober. There's room for people to be passing out at shows. It happens. And the good part is, I think at least that, you know, I think about fish. It's like, what other concert do I go to where I can go to at set break to find 100 sober people just waiting to talk?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there aren't any.
Yeah. Then we're going to get into that, because we do want to talk a little bit about the resources that exist for fans. Jason, you talked a little bit about going to shows with your group of sober fans and friends. What's the experience like now, and how is it different, and how, what does it look like to you?
Yeah, I think Mike hit it right on the head. Is like, and I've just kind of learned this, to seek counsel on a lot of things. Like, if I'm going to do this, like, I need to make sure I'm kind of open with people, what's going on, and making sure, like I have, like he said, I have my tribe, my crew with me. And, you know, my experience was, I don't know if it's better. It's just different. And it's just like, I remember standing in, you know, we were at the Rosemont shows, and being able to like be right in the middle of that moment in the No Man's, you know, jam, and like, wow, this is so much different than what it used to be, where I'd have to go back and like listen to it again. And like, I barely remember even being there. And I think the key to it is, I would never, you know, expect somebody in early sobriety who's just newly getting sober to try to just wing it and just, you know, and to think they can go and be strong enough to do it. You know, this is a disease that is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and will trick you. It'll deceive you, and it'll, you know, your own thoughts aren't the truth. To actually, and that's the coolest part of the fellowship, is to go in and be able to have a group of people like-minded on the same path as you, maybe further along it or just starting it, that you can lean into and have a great time. And I agree with what he said. It's like there really is. I haven't had any judgment or any awkward moments where somebody was trying to give me something I didn't want or anything awkward happening. I still see the naked people at shows, you know, the people that randomly take their clothes off. I think I've seen more people get naked than I have pass out. So it is what it is. And I've kind of learned to let people do what they do. You know, I know I have a lot of friends that still partake of, you know, get drunk and do whatever they're going to do. And they don't, people around them don't suffer consequences for what they do. Guys like me and Mike, everybody around me suffered consequences when I decided to do this stuff, you know, and I was powerless to stop myself. Like my mom and dad, and my wife, all the people around me, they had consequences because I did this. A lot of people I know can do drugs and party and get down and wake up in the morning, shake their head and go, oh, I feel like crap. But they go about their business and their bills get paid and their kids get fed and life is okay. Guys like us, it's just, you know, we're like a tornado just ripping through everybody's lives. So, and not today. We're of usefulness and trying to be, even at a show, like trying to be of service. Like, yeah, I can drive. I'm sober. We're not going to get pulled over and like, you know. It's cool. I think it's such a neat experience, and to be an adult about it and realize we're all older now, and it's just so much different now. It really is like church. It's a spiritual experience every time I go, regardless of what other people are doing. I definitely feel that connectedness of the community now more than ever.
Yeah, that's great. I know, you know, it's probably worth saying. I mean, we all probably I can't speak for you. I mean, most people these days, I feel like, especially in the fish scene, have connections to people that are close to them who have dealt with addiction issues. I mean, I personally have, you know, several very close people in my life who have struggled and you know, been in recovery. And so I have a tremendous admiration for people like you guys who have been able to overcome, you know, such a horrible disease. And one of the things that always blows my mind is, you know, Jason, like you were just saying, the number of times that somebody like that has like volunteered to be a designated driver or something like that, when it would be easy to think that person's like, no, you know what, I want to stay away from this. I'm not going to subject myself to having to deal with a bunch of wasted people or whatever, and instead kind of dive in head first and are like, no, you know what, I can be of service to you guys. I can help you. I can turn this into a positive instead of what I may have been in the past, which would to have been to drag people down. So it's really amazing. You know, I mean, so Trey has been very public about this and open, as we said at the top of the show, particularly recently. I was surprised almost on the Sirius interview to hear how open he was about things like his pre-show ritual. When he mentioned going into the bathroom and kind of trying to reset his thoughts and remind himself of where he came from. He's also given a lot of, you know, speeches about the drug court program, and from what I understand, has made himself available to a lot of people that he's encountered along the way. It's easy for us to look at the music and maybe kind of point to, you know, how his experience has influenced the songwriting, and there's a lot of different theories. But you know, sometimes maybe that's it's projecting, or it's kind of reading into the situation a little bit too much. Jason, I know you have some thoughts on, you know, particularly what you how you think we can kind of see some of Trey's experience in his music. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, anything with, especially with the disease of addiction, and Mike hit it on the head pretty good. It's like there's this, it's like a three-faceted illness. There's the body, the mind, and the spirit, the soul. Your body's affected because you literally physically have a body that cannot process alcohol and drugs. And as you get older, it gets worse. It's like we're just genetically caught this bullet. We're set up this way. Two, you have a brain that's going to lie to you and trick you to going back into it when you don't want to, good day or bad day. And then three is this spirit, the spiritual part of it. And that's what 12-step programs address. You straighten out spiritually, and the body and the mind will follow. And for me, and these prefaces, my opinion, I'm not by any means educated at all on musical theory, anything. But I can go back into a lot of Trey's music and just, you hear God, you hear this, you hear that, this spirit stuff. And maybe that's just because that's where I'm at in my life. I can go back like, Life Boy, you know, God doesn't listen to what I say, and do you get a refund if you over pray? And then Sand, like all these songs, and that's kind of a common theme through a lot of music, because music is spiritual at the end of the day. It's about that connectiveness. But we can see it progress, and me and Mike were talking, especially as of recently. You know, I saw it on the Joy album. You hear a lot of songs talking about being in the now. You know, light, you know, the light between me and my mind, and all these things that that are pointing towards spirituality. But recently, and this is what kind of kicked this off, when I listened to some of the podcasts over the summer, the quick hits, where people are like, you know, what's this Set Your Soul Free and Soul Plan and all this, and every, and I can understand that. The campiness.
Fairly certain I was part of that conversation. Yeah,
I'm sure. And I texted one of my best friends, my best friend in the world, a guy named Ryan Kramer. And like, I'm like, what are your thoughts about, I told him what was going on here about, you know, these new songs. And he's not one of us. He's not an alcoholic or an addict. He's like, it's all about the jam. I don't care what the song's about. It's all about the jam. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. It is. But for guys that are listening a little bit, I can just hear that progression of going from, not self-centeredness, but a song from the viewpoint of self into a song like Set Your Soul Free, Soul Planet, Everything's Right, to a song of giving, a song of community, of getting everybody together. And it's that's what kind of sparked it. I sent RJ an email and said, hey, I might have a little bit of different perspective on this, and kind of not here to clear anything up, but just another pair of eyes and ears on what's going on. And then all of a sudden, bam, we have Trey on the XM thing, and like, say, like on my phone, my screensaver is that exact same prayer. And it's been on my phone forever that he said, it's a prayer of St. Francis. And it's a prayer about, you know, get me out of the way, let me bring love where there's hatred. Let me bring, you know, forgiveness, and let me be an instrument. And that's what, you know, that was very, it really was real touching that he actually was opened up about his process of what he does, prayer before a show.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thanks for sharing that. And Jason, I noticed I was listening back to the drug court speech that he gave in 2011, which is really, really good. And we'll link to that in case people haven't seen it. But at one point he said, he's talking about some of the people he met, and he says the sunlight of the spirit had come into some of these people. And I just noticed that was just one kind of quote, but sort of interesting to see that.
That quote, it's, it comes,
that's, from that's of, literature.
It's comes from one of our literature.
Okay.
When we act this way, we cut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. And that means every day, and Mike knows this, I have a choice when I get up in the morning. Am I going to turn my face to the sun and to the spirit of the universe, to God, whatever that is you want to call it? Or am I going to turn my head towards self and do what I want to do? And if I turn my face towards the sun, I reap the benefits of that. And Mike knows as well as I do, when you see the sunlight of the spirit come into somebody and you watch them recover, that is the coolest thing in my life right now. I love my children. I love my wife, and I will do whatever it takes to keep them. But to watch the lights come on in another alcoholic or an addict and watch them recover and turn around and help somebody else, for a busted up drunk like me, who's was hopeless, dead. That's, man, you want me to drive the fish in Florida, I'll go, whatever you want to do. Like, I'm here to help. I'm here to help.
Mike, what are your thoughts on this piece? And actually, sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but I do want to just say that Ryan Kramer, I think, was one of our earliest fans and listeners. So I'm glad to hear his name, and that I'm glad he's still out there. He sort of disappeared from Twitter, but I hope he's still doing well.
That's my boy.
Cool.
Thanks. So, I mean, I think Jason touched on it. The lyric that I always go back to about addiction, that is probably the best metaphor I've heard in music for it, is just, if you can't heal the symptoms, but not affect the cause, it's quite a bit like trying to heal a gunshot wound with gauze. And that's, I feel like Trey's addiction song, just talking about like, okay, it's the metaphor that I heard in treatment before I heard Sand was, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. If you're trying to just patch things up, you have to heal the whole self. So, I mean, for sure. And I am a little bit more jaded, I think, than Jason about the soul planet and the all the soul stuff. But that's just, you know, that's the type of fish fan I am, I guess. And but it is, I mean, it's been clear even from, you know, got a blank space where my mind should be, got a Cliff Bar and some cold green tea. I'm like, oh, he's going to meditate somewhere. Yep. Got it.
Yeah.
Totally on board. And, you know, the piece is about, you know, and everything's right about going downhill with increasing speed and then focus on tomorrow and all of that. A lot of the language feels familiar to those of us who would know that language. Does that make sense? It's like being fish itself is like being in a secret club, and then it's like being in the secret club inside of the secret club.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we should say that a lot of the lyrics are written, of course, by Tom and some by Tom and Trey collaboratively, and then some by the whole band, et cetera. So don't want to make it. We all know that, but I just want to throw that out there as I mentioned to you, Jason, via email, when I read Tom's lyrics, I see an evolution of a different kind, but an evolution, right, from early sort of angst about things to more acceptance and happiness with where things have ended up. And I think Tom and Trey have remained sort of on the same page about that, you know, and they both seem to be fairly forward looking and accepting of where things are right now, which is really cool to see.
Well, the other thing that I would add on top of that is that you could probably see a difference in the lyrics that Tom has written, like Sand and Kill Devil Falls and some of the ones that we mentioned, where you can kind of apply that to the situation, but you could also say that maybe, you know, the influence of Trey's experience and his metamorphosis, so to speak, may have, you know, kind of spilled out and influenced his friend and the interactions that that they have, versus the soul songs, which I believe are all Trey lyrics, and are probably a little bit more on the nose in terms of what you guys are talking about.
Yeah.
The songs I look at and I hear every time, and I just think of, you know, when the new guy or woman walks in the door and you see him just hurting so bad and you just want to wrap your arms around him, listen to the lyrics of Tide Turns. And that's what it's like to watch somebody coming in. And we said, when the wolf is at your door and the mirror holds your nightmare. And there's a Jason Isbell lyric that describes that perfectly. You know, I'm stuck in a room with the person I judge worse than anybody else. And it's like, you know, when you're in the depths of alcoholism and addiction, like, you know, you're doing wrong and you hate yourself so bad, but you can't stop. And then you walk into a 12-step group and people are there just to put their arms around you and their hands out and to show you the way. And that song Tide Turns just reminds me so much of what that's all about.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that with regard to that song, but it makes total sense. You mention it. I have a lot of questions for you guys, but I don't know what's appropriate or we have time for, but in terms of the, I thought about this when listening to the Sirius piece, the thing that's on your phone that he talked about, the prayer, the St. Francis, I forget what you called it, but that particular prayer. And then when he says letting God out, is that specific to Christianity, or is that something that is more broadly interpreted in whatever way people who are part of some different kinds of programs interpret it, if that question makes sense?
Go ahead, Mike. You can describe this better than me, probably.
Sure. I mean, I think the general, you know, the gist of the St. Francis prayer is just to be an instrument of your peace. Let me, where there's hate, so love. It's really just about kind of being a light. So although it comes from Catholic tradition, I think, you know, at least in my experience anyway, it can work for everybody with the right lens. Right. I think that's the big piece. But where there is doubt, faith; where there is despair, hope; where there is darkness, light; and where there is sadness, joy. That's a pretty good reset, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just, and I think one of the key parts of that, to think about the prayer of St. Francis, is like the mystical part of it. These are truths, whether you want to believe in Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism or, you know, Muslim. This is, you live a life based on this thing, you're going to be all right. And the biggest part is seek to understand rather than to be understood. And that's the big thing, going into a situation where it's not about me. I don't need to get my viewpoint across. I don't need to barrage you with ego and pride and all this, and just be able to have empathy and sympathy and be like, you know, what is, you know, real care and concern is and that's where Trey says he does that and walks out on a stage and thinks about that one person there trying to get sober, you know.
That makes sense. And I guess another question, you described, Jason, I don't know if you see the world in this particular dichotomy, but there are people who have, you know, obviously this is a disease that you've dealt with, and I think we all acknowledge that, but is it that some people can go have go have beers and whatever and be fine, and some people can't? And if so, if how do you know when you're at that point where you can't control, or where you know that you need to seek help, or how do you know?
Well, for me, it was, there's two questions that I always ask, and I'm actively involved in 12-step and sponsor men and help out a lot and do what I can. But I always want to know, there's two points, choice and control. When you drink or you do whatever you do, if you want to have three, can you have three? Can you have three every time? If you want to have seven, can you have seven every time? Or do you miss the mark? You know, do you go to the bar to have a couple beers with the boys, and next thing you know, it's 3 a.m. and you think you've changed your mind? You know, something's happened. Something internally's happened. And this is, and Mike knows this, and he'll probably reiterate it because he's in this field, that there's only 10 to 15% of the population that have this. You know, why did me and Ryan Kramer, right? He's a great example. Why did me and him partook in a lot of stuff, great stuff, tons of fun. Why did he, you know, grow up and get on with his life? And why did I continue down this path? And it's like, you know, well, he had somewhere to be, is what I always say. He had a life to go live. And I had to go this path, but I just, you know, it's a genetic disorder. I caught that, that bullet, and it's kind of riddled through my family. But, so when if you can control the amount you take. And the second part is, this is the kicker, is when you want to stay stopped, can you stay stopped? When you're on your couch crying to your wife or your mom and your dad, and we hook you up to a lie detector test and it says, RJ, will you ever drink again? And you're sitting there sniveling, no, I'll never drink again, I promise. And the lie detector test says, RJ, you are telling the truth. But by Sunday at kickoff time, you've snuck out the back door to go get a 12-pack, you know, because this mind is tricky you back into it. Those are the two things, and underneath that is a whole lot of other stuff, but that's the basis of it. Can you stay stopped when you really want to stay stopped? And when you do what you want to do, can you control it? Because there's a lot of people I know that 2 a.m. when I thought the party was ready to keep going, they looked at their watch and said, what, I gotta go, and put whatever it was that was on the table in their pocket and left.
Yep. That's really cool and really helpful to hear. Mike, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. The only other thing I would add, I mean, I think what Jason said was really insightful and makes a lot of sense. I think the piece that I see that's the big differentiator in my world tends to be consequences. If you're experiencing consequences, whether they're emotional or legal, which is a lot of the time, or really that's the big piece. And, you know, I think Jason, what you said is really important. The power of choice is the biggest. That's the biggest thing. If you find yourself not being able to go a day or two without, I mean, it's a good, what I give folks who call me that are looking for help, I'm like, take a week and see if you can't drink, or you can't use drugs, or you can't do it in a safe way. And if you can't do that, then it might be something you want to take a look at. And that's all. I look at it like, I mean, I see this as disease model too. And I think of, you know, I think of addiction as genetics load the gun and environment pulls the trigger. So I know a lot of people who come from really alcoholic homes who are just have a really normal relationship with substances. And I know people who come from great homes with super supportive parents who are really blown out on drugs by the time they're 18. And it is what it is, you know. Yep. You can't predict it. And but I look at it, alcoholism, addiction tends to be a disease of relationships. That when your primary relationship is with a substance, you can't have primary relationships with anyone else. Mm-hmm. And you will build your life around that, because I mean, the truth is drugs and alcohol work really well until they don't. And that's the part that we need to get to, right? It's like, okay, if you're feeling, I think even though we tend to lose a lot of our internal compass when we're deep in our addiction, I think there is a piece of anyone who struggled with addiction that knows when you've gotten in too deep. And then it's the question of, all right, how do I ask for help? And that's the bigger piece. So I think the shame of it kills more people than anything else, of having to say, I'm struggling, I'm really hurting, I need to get out. That's where I see people get lost.
So you guys did a great job of painting the picture of what people might look for. That's probably a good lead in to ask the question. Well, then if they hit that point, particularly for a Phish fan, let's keep it somewhat on topic here. What resources exist for them inside of the Phish community? I mean, what advice would you give to somebody who's saying, like, you know, I think I might have a problem?
Mm-hmm. What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. One, I mean, we're in the Phish off season, as I like to call it, other than Mexico. But, you know, really, if you're hearing this now and you're struggling, hit either of us up on Twitter or email me or any of, you know, there is a good amount of us that are just out here living our lives in a sober way that can get you plugged into somebody locally. Or if you just need an ear, I mean, I keep my DMs open on Twitter just because sometimes people just need to talk. And I know for me anyway, like I don't care what condition your condition is in. If you need somebody to talk to, I'm here to talk, you know, and that's the big piece here. I think it feels really scary to say, I'm really struggling with this, or I'm really in a hole and I don't know how I'm going to get out. That's scarier to say than I'm a drug addict, I think. I mean, that's saying, you know, I'm struggling and I feel like I'm, you know, I'm really in the middle of it and not seeing the light out. And that, I think, is where that exists at shows and on the internet and on Facebook and all over the place. The Fellowship with a PH is an amazing group. I mean, I've been at, when we were in Tahoe in 13, there were like 75 people out of a 6,000 person show that were hanging out at the table before the show. And then at set break, there were about 200. I mean, it's all, and you don't have to be in a recovery program. It's just, if you want to try a show sober and you want some support while you're doing it, that's a big deal. And then also, you know, this is what I do professionally. So if you need a resource, if you need a therapist, or if you need a treatment center, you can contact me anytime and I will happily get you there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, thank you for bringing the fellowship into it. And I think I'm the same way. If you know, the amount of resources that between Mike and me, like I'm on the other side of the country. He's West Coast and he knows everybody from West Coast, East Coast, but I have the same connections all the way from Texas, all the way up to the East Coast. So if there's anybody where you guys are at, I'm the same way. Like my phone's on me all the time. You know, whatever you need, if you needed somebody to listen to, a connection somewhere to go to, you know, please, I was just, you know, don't let shame and don't let fear stop you from reaching out to one of us, you know, directly. It doesn't bother me one bit, and not at all.
And I'll speak for Jason too. We'll keep it totally quiet. So if you're reaching out, you don't want anybody to know about it. Nobody will ever know about it.
Yeah. Mom's the word.
Yeah. Once again, as I said earlier, I'm a great admirer. I love any time I wind up in the hallway. It just happened at MSG and it happened at Hampton too. And you start hearing everybody, these cheers and these chants coming from one part of the hallway. And it's like, what's going on over there? I've got to be a part of that. And I know, not to make light of it or anything, but my wife loves the fellowship table because she always stops by and gets candy. She's not a drinker, not because of any issues, but because it's just not her bag. But she always stops by and says hi and make sure to get some candy and look for the yellow balloons. So we talked a little bit about the resources that people might find in the community. Then let's talk a little bit about the people who are not on the same journey as you guys. And I wanted to share a little story kind of lead to set the scene for the question. I had kind of two opposing experiences when Phish came back in 2009. And leading up to that in 2008, I don't know if you guys remember this, but Trey, his first tour back before Phish came back after he had been in drug court was he did a tour with just the rhythm section from Tab, and they played small venues, and it seemed like the purpose was to get Trey back on his kind of get his sea legs again for playing on stage and stuff, because it had been a couple of years. And I went to the last show on that tour, which was in Richmond at the National, and saw him walk out on stage with this huge beaming smile on his face, and they launched into the first song, and he was jumping up and down. And I turned to my friend Doug standing next to me, and I said, God, I don't think I've ever seen anybody so happy to be on stage playing music as he is right now. Even, you know, despite all the times that I had seen Trey play before that, there was just this unbelievable light about him. We found out later in the show that his wife and kids were at the show. So I think that the whole kind of thing, you know, that point in his life and having his family there and everything, it really was like the perfect storm of happiness for him. So I was really excited when Phish came back. Fast forward to the following summer, and really for the first couple years of the 3.0 era, when the band was kind of getting, you know, trying to jive again a little bit. And we all know, we've talked about this before, they, you know, weren't necessarily jamming as much. And even Trey said in this recent Sirius interview that he thought that it took them till, you know, probably 2012 or 2013 to really, you know, hit their stride again. And I started seeing all these comments on the internet and from people who would say things like, you know, Trey's sober, so he just can't jam anymore. Or Trey just needs to loosen up. He needs to smoke some weed or drop some acid before a show. You know, that's not the stuff that he had problems with. He needs to do this stuff so he can loosen up. And I was so shocked, having had that experience before, of like witnessing this man and his transformation and how happy it was, that people who supposedly, you know, this community that loves him, that people would say something like that and disrespect him as a person and as a family man and really turn it into this selfish kind of like, you know, you have to do what I want. So, you know, put your health in jeopardy again. And the reason why I said all that is, you know, I wanted to ask, what is it that other fans in the community can do and should be doing to be respectful to people on a recovery journey? And do you have any advice for anybody? I think you guys would probably admit, and you sort of have already, like the expectation is not that when you walk into a crowd, everybody needs to, you know, put their beers away and not do anything that you wouldn't do. And you know, kind of like, you know, drain the life out of the party or anything like that. That's yours to kind of be able to enter that scene and know that you can handle yourself. But is there an attitude that you think needs to change among the crowd, or is there anything, you know, that people can do to be more supportive? Jason, why don't we start with you?
You know what? I don't think so. I think, at least for my experience, is that it's about the attitude and the perception I'm bringing to the venue, to the show itself. Am I coming in here on edge, like, okay, what's going on around me? Or am I coming in there spiritually centered, like everything's going to be okay? And I've never had, you know, there was some stuff going on behind us at Rosemont that, you know, white powder substance that I used to really like, and it's going down. And I'm like, they're okay. It's no big deal. It's like, I wasn't like, put your drugs away. You're really bothering me. You're triggering me. You know, it wasn't. I think when you were saying that, the thing that popped into my mind really is like, anytime in life, you know, the biggest amount of change we can affect is in our personal relationships. It's like, as a whole, I think that the community is supportive with what's going on. I've never seen anything go down at all bad at a show as far as respecting somebody's sobriety, because I'm not walking around a show saying, no, thank you, I don't want that beer, I'm sober. You know, no, thanks. We had a guy walk by us. He had a big, like, huge, they sell hard alcohol at Rosemont. It is big, like Captain Morgan. Hey, you want a drink? And I'm like, nah, we're cool. And it was two recovered alcoholics. Like, nah, we're okay. And it's just, it's laugh it, you know, just, but I think for me, what I would say to the Phish fans out that are listening, that have somebody in their life that's struggling with addiction, is hold them accountable. I think that's the big thing that prohibited me from getting sober a long time ago, was my family and the people around me loved me, almost loved me to death, because they just wanted me to be happy and just kind of skate around and kind of not address the issue, because there were some issues with them and just some family stuff. I think the thing that I would say is just, you know, if you really love somebody, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is apathy. Of just putting your hands up saying, you know, you're going to do what you're going to do and I can't do anything about it. And I just think that's bullshit. I think we have a responsibility to others, whether it's alcoholism and addiction or any kind of mental health or anything in life, whatever it is, I think we do owe it to each other to hold each other accountable, to say, hey, this is not cool. You know, you need to figure this out. And, you know, I was always taught, sometimes we got to bring the bottom to them. We can't wait for them to come down. And pain, Mike knows this. The only thing that ever motivates guys like me and Mike is pain. Even today, like I'm on a spiritual path, and it's good, it's bad, it's indifferent, it goes up and down. But the one thing that motivates me to adjust my course is, holy shit, this is painful. I need to, what am I doing wrong? What do I need to adjust? And do like an inventory of myself of what's going on. So that would be it for me, is more than anything, is if you know somebody in your life that is suffering from alcoholism and addiction, look at the path of holding them accountable, whether it's an intervention, whether it's just sitting down them face to face saying, I love you, but I'm not going to watch you kill yourself. Because, and like you said, to people that are so selfish and they want another person to adjust who they are, to meet their selfish needs, especially when they're an addict like Trey, and like we're blessed that Trey is able to go on stage every night, because it got dark and it got bad, and it could be a whole different story today. We could all not be here, and we could be mourning the loss of one of the greatest guitar players ever. You know, it really could be that way. And that's doom and gloom, but you know, thank God somebody held him accountable, and it was the judicial system. And like we saw, he's very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whatever it takes. Some of us are arrested. You know, some of us are, you know, right. So what do you got, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Fish came back and there was all the, they don't jam anymore. What's the deal? What's going on? Trey needs to drop acid and go. I remember those conversations and having them like pre-show. And then, then it really just depended on what the opener was, and then it was fine. But really, I mean, I think the big piece to remember for me that, and I tweeted this earlier today because somebody had posted, it's Trey's 12 years today, and when we're recording this, and you know, I was thinking about we're in the bonus round,
yeah.
Like Fish should be gone. This is, you know, this is what, you know, look at the dead, right? They could still be playing today if Jerry had gotten sobriety and gotten that gift. And, you know, I think about all that stuff, and it puts into perspective whether Party Time or not was played or not. And, you know, and it puts into perspective all my, you know, the stuff that I think about, like, oh, I had to miss this show because I had this commitment, or I had to miss, you know, or this show was kind of off, or it was a little blah. But it's like, well, we still have shows, and that's pretty amazing. And we still get that experience, and that in his sobriety, Trey has continued to do this for us, you know, this, and for him. I think that's the big part. I think the part for me that feels the best about 3.0, the thing that feels the most important about 3.0 to me, is it feels like Trey is here and this is what he wants to do, and he's going to do it until he's done. And that's amazing, because I don't know if that was always the case. You know, it's hard when you're on tour and you're running a machine and you're making sure 100 people get paid every month. It's hard. And now I think it feels like he's settled into a groove and is in a better spot, and it's allowed the music to flow a little bit better. I think it also just takes time. You know, you take time off, you go back to do something, takes time to balance. But and at shows, I think the thing that's always worked for me in almost any social situation is just to say I'm not drinking tonight, and people generally don't ask me any questions about that. And then if they want to ask questions about it, I will happily tell them why, and you know why. Here's my entire story. I'm kidding, I won't tell you my whole life story. But there is a piece of that where you can disclose as much or as little as you want. And at shows, I think, you know, I get offered, and it's just saying, you know, not tonight, but thanks. And that's worked well for me. And look for yellow pins and yellow balloons in the crowd. Mm-hmm. If you're struggling and you're sitting there, and my rule with my crew that I tour with is no powders. Everything else is fine. That's just for me. I'm like, if I see powders on a table, I get triggered. After 15 years, it still comes up. And I'm like, that's my general rule. And what I've learned is that when you set a boundary, most people will respect it. And if they don't, then they're probably not people you want to be seeing the show with anyway. So that's the big piece. And if you have somebody you're concerned about, like Jason, what you were talking about, and you want to know more about how to have that conversation, those are the conversations that I have almost every day, just professionally and then also personally. So happy to walk you through it. It's like anything else. It's terrifying if it's the first thing you did, but you've got two guys here on the phone that have been doing this, then have these conversations that are used to that. And I think about, trying to deal with addiction or trying to deal with a family member with addiction is like if I slid a piano across to you and said, play me Beethoven's Fifth right now. It's like, well, why would I know how to do this? Mm-hmm. But if I said, okay, in a year after you've had some practice and you've had somebody leading you on your journey, you're probably going to do okay. And if you don't, you're probably going to know I put in the effort and I did the best I could. So it's okay to ask for help about this stuff. And there are a lot of people out there who are the helpers. And, you know, it's the old Mr. Rogers saying, always look for the helpers because we're here and we're around. And, you know, and sometimes we don't want to be interrupted during a tweezer jam to talk about your heroin addiction, but I will talk to you afterwards. I have no problem with that.
Time well and place said. For everything.
I can neither confirm nor deny that has happened. So that's this.
It's like, thank you for sharing, but the band's on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Ooh, I want that shirt. That's a good shirt. I'm writing that down right now.
Yeah. I'd have been like, I'm pretty sure you're not going to be going anywhere. So we'll get to it later.
Well, guys, this has been really fascinating, and right, we could go on forever, but we shouldn't, in the interest of our families and also maybe our listeners. But people, I'm sure, have enjoyed what we've been able to talk about so far. I want to just say I share Matt's admiration, you know, for you guys for not just living through this and doing what you have to do, but also being willing to talk about it and going out and going into environments like fish shows. That it's interesting to me that you don't have to leave your whole life behind. I guess that's like a stereotype that's in my head, that if you get sober or you change whatever you used to do, that you kind of people move or they don't hang out with the same people or that sort of thing. But it's good that you guys are not, that you don't have to lose this big part of your life that has meant so much to you and now does again.
And it's meant more to me in recovery than it ever did before, to be totally frank. Like, it's a way, I think, just a sense of community and actually kind of knowing who I am versus the person I showed you when I was using. Actually knowing who I am and being able to show up in that way feels way better than just going to a show and getting super loaded and then having to look at the set list to remember what they played 3 minutes after the show was over. So that part, you know, that still happens now that I'm getting older, but it's at least there's an different excuse for it.
And I think Trey shares that same feeling almost. I think he said almost that exact same thing. So that's really cool. And Jason, thanks for, you know, bringing this up to us and encouraging us to talk about this.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you guys for doing it. It's been fun, and it's like we said earlier, hopefully we can get hook a couple people and get them connected, you know, try to be of service somehow here. So
right on. Well, I think we'll leave people with some music. I think the only thing I want to say is just thanks everybody for listening. And if you have thoughts, feedback, comments, and all that, obviously send them to us via Twitter, email, Facebook, whatever you prefer to use. And we will link to both Mike and Jason's Twitter accounts in here and talk about, and we'll link to some of the resources they talked about as well. Matt, what else do we need to say before we wrap up?
Nothing else. I mean, I'll just echo that. Thank you guys so much for sharing, for being great, you know, role models for people out there who might be struggling, for offering yourselves to help. And we talked about this, you know, in the lead up to recording today. But, you know, if this helps one person out there, then, you know, hopefully it's not just been informative, but it's also been of service to the community. So really appreciate you guys, you know, coming on and sharing with us.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, guys. And so with that, we will see you all back here in a couple weeks where we will continue to talk about fish. So have fun out there and keep on rocking.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.